This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 3rd of March 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, the Republican establishment takes aim at Donald Trump. First, 60 foreign policy experts claim he'll undermine US security. Then Mitt Romney calls him a phony and a fraud. But will it make any difference? My guests, Daniela Pelled and James Rogers, will give us their take. British voters are warned by French and German politicians not to leave the European Union. But do these interventions actually help? And in Russia, Putin's popularity is at its highest for 4 years, according to a new poll. Is the support genuine? All that plus we'll discuss the refugees set to fly their flag at the Rio Olympics. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Daniela Pelled, Acting Managing Editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and James Rogers, Senior Lecturer in Journalism at City University here in London. Welcome to you both. The Republican establishment is finally fighting back. Dozens of Republican foreign policy veterans have issued a stark warning: the dangers of a Trump presidency. In an open letter, they claim President Trump would undermine US security and diminish America's standing in the world. Signatories include Bob Zoellick, former head of the World Bank and Deputy Secretary of State, and Michael Chertoff, who was the former US Homeland Security Secretary under George W. Bush. We also heard today from Mitt Romney, remember him, the 2012 presidential candidate called Donald Trump a phony and a fraud. James Rogers, does this make any difference, though, now? Isn't it a bit late?
I think it may well be. I think it makes a difference in the sense that after Super Tuesday, the Republican establishment has finally woken up to the fact that Mr. Trump is the most likely candidate for the general election, and they are very concerned. So they're trying to find out weak points. One has to say, though, but from the way that Mr. Trump has conducted his campaign so far, that getting criticism from the political establishment is probably precisely what he wants in some senses. He has positioned himself as being outside that. His constituency sees him as a rebel, despite the fact that he's an extremely wealthy property developer. And one wonders if this could actually end up being counterproductive. And one imagines that, although there's nothing certain in any political system in the West at the moment, that the Democrats are probably the ones who are rubbing their hands with the greatest glee at the moment.
Daniela Pelled, is there an argument that, okay, fine, Trump supporters, they won't change their mind over this. They are set, they know what they believe, and the fact that establishment Republicans like Mitt Romney, we've also heard from John McCain today talking about Trump's uninformed and dangerous statements, various other foreign policy, Washington DC, bigwigs, this is all the sorts of things that those people don't like. Fine. But there are some in the middle, aren't they, who would normally vote for a Republican who might be swayed by this?
I don't think this will be the definitive thing that sways them. I think if they'd be swayed by common sense, really. I mean, it's absolutely right. Trump has positioned himself as the outsider despite coming from a place of immense privilege. And this absolutely plays into his positioning. It's interesting to see that his discourse on foreign policy has, if anything, become dumbed down over the years. He's making a lot less sense now than, the rare times that he talked about foreign affairs, 10, 15 years ago. It's something very calculated about this. I think we're going to be talking about Europe later. And I think with the Trump candidacy, it's another prime example of how feelings and emotions and sort of deep-seated intangibles really play such a strong part in politics, because Trump is saying, I'm going to make America great again, and all these foreign influences and outside forces are sinister, and I can beat them down. It's not about logic. It's absolutely about emotion.
James, there's also surely something to be said about you know, John McCain and Mitt Romney should also be criticised for helping to foment this in the first place. John McCain, let's not forget, chose Sarah Palin as his vice presidential candidate. If you roll back 4 years, Mitt Romney was quite happy to stand next to Donald Trump and get his endorsement to be president, and made jokes about how he's obviously a better businessman than he's made more money, and said how he really looks forward to campaigning with him. You know, these people have aided and abetted Trump, haven't they?
They have. I mean, I think probably, as they thought at the time, in the certain knowledge that the current state of affairs couldn't come to pass. And I think this is really, I think what we've seen from the political establishment, and including the Republican establishment in the United States thus far, is, oh, it's not going to happen, oh, it's not going to happen. And now it seems more than likely that it is going to happen. I think that they're very concerned. I mean, I think there's another point as well, perhaps, to consider here. Except in times of war, people do not generally tend in Western democracies to vote on foreign affairs. It's the economy which is the most sort of pressing issue in some way. So in a way, one wonders if the Republican establishment has perhaps not picked the greatest ground on which to fight if they're trying to damage Mr. Trump's march towards what, albeit almost inevitable march now towards the nomination.
Daniela, it's been interesting in the sense that Donald Trump's opponents in the Republican primary haven't attacked him in the same way that Romney and McCain have attacked him. They've actually attacked him from the right, strangely enough, with Ted Cruz saying, oh, we don't know if he's a true conservative. Marco Rubio at the last debate attacked him for the potential use of immigrants, the possible use of immigrants building his buildings. Whereas you listen to Mitt Romney and he says, he calls for killing the innocent children and family members of terrorists. This is the very brand of anger that has led other nations into the abyss. He also goes on as well to talk about this issue when Donald Trump said he saw thousands of Muslims in New Jersey celebrating 9/11. Wrong. He saw no such thing. This is what Donald Trump's actual opponents should have been saying, isn't it?
It's a much more sensible approach, absolutely. I think that attacking him from the right, it's a strange position to be in. You know, he seems untouchable, and I think they have been flailing about. And I agree, but with the foreign policy, it's not foremost in the minds of most voters. But I think Trump's take on it, that can be encapsulated as the threat to America and the threat to the economy, I mean, that's basically his foreign policy. So I think from that point of view, foreign policy, such as it is, has been a major part of his appeal.
James, when we look ahead to the general election, you know, this is all, as you say, you know, looking pretty good for Hillary Clinton. At the very least, she's going to have some very good campaign adverts just from Mitt Romney, from John McCain. We've also heard Marco Rubio calling him a liar. You know, you can put all this in ads, and it's just Republicans eating themselves.
It is, and so it really. But of course, Mrs. Clinton herself is a divisive figure in American politics, and it'll be interesting to see how many of those don't knows she can bring to her side, or the undecided voters. All that said, one can imagine that don't knows are not likely to vote for Mr. Trump in the same way as they might for another less controversial candidate, I would imagine. I don't think people are going to go on voting day and think, oh, I'm going to just vote for a sort of candidate whom I trust. I mean, I think you're going to vote for Mr. Trump, it's because you've got quite strong views on quite a lot of things, I would think.
Daniela, you were talking earlier about how people are choosing the politicians they want to vote for based on feelings and emotions rather than necessarily facts and figures. And there's an interesting cover story on the front of the Bloomberg Business Week that came out today, which rather graphically points out that Europe has nothing to boast about when it comes to Donald Trump. We've got Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, we've got Marine Le Pen in France, we've had Silvio Berlusconi in Italy, here in the UK we've got our very own sort of sub-Trump in Nigel Farage. What is it, do you think, about these political leaders that is giving them this level of support at the moment?
I think it's a widespread phenomenon, as you point out, and there is this idea, all of these people, all of these leaders position themselves as the outsiders, even though they come from the place of white male European privilege, all those things. But they've managed the magic trick. You know, people feel disempowered, they feel disenfranchised, and you know, it's all about the feels. You know, they feel under threat. You know, Europe feels under threat as never before. So psychologically, people are very vulnerable to that. But you know, I would stand up in defense of Great Britain, say that, well, we have Nigel Farage, but Nigel Farage is no Donald Trump, and he's no Jean-Marie Le Pen. I don't know how we will do when it comes to the referendum here on the EU, but so far I think we're holding up our end as a reasonable nation.
We'll come on to the referendum in just a moment, but James, on that point, of all those people I just listed off, only Silvio Berlusconi has actually so far got into office, and that was in Italy with its strange PR system, and also, frankly, after decades and decades of scandals. Are we getting too worried about these types of people? You know, they make a noise, they, as we've discussed, they have a core support, but expanding that to majority support is very difficult.
It is, and even in those countries which have proportional representation, it hasn't always, you know, they haven't always taken full advantage of the electoral successes which they've had. I mean, to consider another country, if we look at Denmark, the Danish People's Party, they garnered somewhere north of 20% of the vote in the last general election and decided not to join the coalition. So in a way, they're trying to enjoy the eternal luxury of opposition, and in a way not taking the responsibility that might come with having a larger share of the vote.
Let's turn now to that EU referendum that Daniela mentioned. Britain received fresh warnings about what its departure from the EU could mean over the last 24 hours. French Economy Minister Emmanuel Macron says France would end border controls and let thousands of refugees move on to Britain if voters backed leaving the EU. Germany's finance minister also spoke out in favour of Britain staying in. And on top of that, the German carmaker BMW has written to its British employees who make its Rolls-Royce cars to warn them about the risks the firm will face if Britain votes to leave Europe or the European Union. Daniela, does any of this actually make any difference, though?
Well, I think if anything, it's somewhat counterproductive, because people who are wobbling on the issue and unlikely to be encouraged to make up their mind to vote in because of their being threatened by the French or the Germans, that's exactly what has annoyed people so much. So everyone is making these noises. I don't think it will make a huge amount of difference. The polls seem to be, you know, fairly evenly split, 50-50 or 60-40 in favour of staying in. What we now need to see is for their out camp to make a coherent enough argument, because what they're asking for is, it's very easy to say, European Union, perfidy of Brussels and so on and so forth. But they're asking people to take a step into the unknown. And that is much, much scarier. And it's not helped by the fact that the camp is hopelessly split. It covers a multiplicity of views. So I think if we're the struggle now for people who want to support to stay in is to try and keep their lot from going over to the other side.
James, you can see the parameters of this debate now, can't you? On the for those saying let's stay in, it's very much look, this is fine for us at the moment. What happens next? We don't know. It's going to be very risky. Oh, did you hear what the French are going to say here? Oh, look, there might be some jobs at risk. And on the other side, you've got people saying, this is scaremongering. Come on, believe in Britain. We're better than this. Yeah. That's basically it, isn't it?
It is. And every single burning political issue is somehow shoehorned into this debate. We've seen both sides saying that the situation with migrants and refugees in Calais is somehow supportive or beneficial to their cause, and they're saying, well, if we stay in, this will get better, or if we go out, this will get better. I mean, I think one thing that's characterised the debate in this country prior to the naming of the date of the referendum, or prior to Mr Cameron's beginning his negotiations with his European counterparts, is that it has entirely been led by the out movement in the form of the UK Independence Party. And it's only really now that in terms of the examples like this letter today or the recent letter that was written by big supermarkets, some of which signed and some of which didn't, pointing out the benefits of British membership, that the camp has really started to make its case. But, of course, you know, you rightly point out this fear of uncertainty, and I think the in-camp is probably hoping they will experience something like appears to have happened in the Scottish referendum of a year and a half ago, which was that people in the end decided that they would rather stick with what they knew rather than take a risk. And I think the in-camp is hoping that will be one of the factors that will deliver them victory.
I'm glad you mentioned the Scottish referendum. I think you're the first person I've actually heard on air use the Scottish referendum as an example of exactly what the in campaign should do. Because so far, Daniela, it's like we're living in this fantasy world where actually the Scottish referendum was won by those seeking independence. If you hear Nicola Sturgeon or Alex Salmond, they're going on about how, oh, well, you mustn't repeat the mistakes you made there where you banged on about the economy. And you think, well, how? But yeah. But that campaign won by 10 points.
That's not what happened, is it? Well, but also I think it's also a question of, look, the level of the debate so far has not been very comforting and not been very exciting. But I also think it's for those who want to make the argument to stay in, it's a question of waiting and seeing, because so far people making the unholy alliance between Nigel Farage and George Galloway, you know, sit back, let's see what happens, you know, wait for enough clunkers to be dropped. I also think people's patience and people's sympathy for this is not endless. If anybody is wavering, they're going to make up their mind right at the end. That's my feeling.
That's very true. Yeah, I was talking recently to a very seasoned observer of EU affairs, and he was saying things could go wrong in the British referendum, and he was in favour of Britain staying in. If suddenly there's a big refugee crisis in the Middle East, even though it's got nothing directly to do with the European Union, it might be the kind of uncertain and worrying event that people witness from a distance and think, oh, we want to shut ourselves off.
Okay. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still to come, we'll discuss Russia and Vladimir Putin, as well as refugees at the Olympics. Do stay tuned.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
There's something about Tokyo, once you're here and you live here, it gets more and more interesting. Doesn't matter how long I'm here, there's always something new. It's a very, it's such a big city, but I think also it's just one of these very layered cities. There's more to discover all the time. And also there's so much that's new in Tokyo. Most months, actually most weeks, there's something new to keep us interested. You know, either it's a new development or a, you know, really interesting new building, a new fashion brand, something going on. So there's always something to keep us interested.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Weighing in at almost 400 pages, the Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The book is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. And it's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks too. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in, and it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cozy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me here in Studio One, Daniela Peled and James Rogers. To Russia now, where President Vladimir Putin's popularity shows no sign of waning. Public support for him to serve another term as president has hit its highest level in 4 years, a new survey shows. Now, 74% of Russians would vote to re-elect him. Russian Public Opinion Research Centre says Mr. Putin's approval rating meetings have risen among many social groups, including young people. It shows that the support for him to stay has risen dramatically since 2012, when just 40% of Russians said they'd vote for him to be elected again. Daniela Peled, imagine you're Russian, you're sitting at home, the phone rings, and the Russian Public Opinion Research Centre calls and says, is that Daniela Peled? Do you support Vladimir Putin? You're unlikely to say no, aren't you?
Absolutely. But from what I've read on the subject, more independent polling actually comes up with the same sort of figure. I'm not surprised at all by this levels of support. In some ways, I'm surprised that the official figures aren't a little bit higher. There's so many reasons behind it. Media, his recent history in Russia. But I remember my first visit to Russia about 10 years ago, and that predated the Georgia War, it predated Ukraine. And I was still surprised by the, you know, I mean, as you know, journalists do, they come in and they chat to a few people and they get anecdotes. But still, you know, Putin seemed super popular amongst lots of young, intelligent, otherwise apparently liberal people. And they weren't too keen on discussing it. But definitely, yeah, I'm not surprised at all.
And it's also, James, if you look back to the Boris Yeltsin years, which, you know, those in the West remember as a bit of a joke, really. They had this drunk president, but, you know, on the whole, you know, Russia was modernising. Oh, God, and then it all changed when this ex-KGB guy came in. Well, Russians don't remember that as a joke at all, do they? And actually, for many Russians, they look at what Vladimir Putin did, especially in the early years, as really sort of restoring Russian pride.
Very much so. I mean, they look on, I think they remember the Yeltsin years probably for two things. I mean, they remember it for desperate economic hardship, which is something I don't think was ever fully understood in the West. And I lived in Russia for a number of years in the 1990s. And they also remember it for embarrassment on the international stage, because those incidents that, like Mr. Yeltsin taking the conductor's baton and conducting a military orchestra, I think it was in Berlin, or failing to get off the plane in a stop over in Ireland when he was returning from a visit to the United States, and it transpired later from his bodyguard's memoirs, at least, that as many suspected, Mr. Yeltsin had too much to drink to get off the plane. Deeply embarrassing. I mean, occasionally amusing, but not generally so. And I remember being there, that one had this very strong sense that were a former general to stand for election and promise sort of order in the streets and sausage on the shelves, they would probably have won. And that's more or less what they got, actually, in the end. And I think it was interesting to be in Eastern Europe at that time and see dissidents becoming presidents in Poland and the Czech Republic, and then a former officer in the secret police becoming president in Russia. So, but it said something about the way that Russia saw its experience of the 1990s very much, I think.
Well, certainly Russia went in a very different direction from the Czech Republic, but, well, at least initially, obviously.
Yeah.
That's changed again somewhat now. James, are you... you know, again, when we look at Putin from a Western perspective, do you think that actually, you know, as Daniela said, 74% is actually understandable when you look at how he's positioned himself, and also what he's done in terms of foreign policy and making, as he would argue it, making Russians feel proud of being Russian again?
Yes, I think that's very true. I mean, the one thing that, and I remember discussing this with some sort of Kremlin insiders at around the time of the 2007 parliamentary elections in Russia, and I said to them, you know, why don't you have free elections? You'd win anyway. And they would have done, and I think they still would. These figures are perhaps a little difficult to take at face value. But again, I think that the basic point holds. I don't think there's nothing made up about Mr. Putin's popularity. That is genuine. And foreign affairs is very much part of it. I mean, if Mr. Putin has achieved one thing over the last 15 years or so, it has been to understand his electorate perfectly. And getting back Crimea was a massive thing for Russian nationalism. People, you would talk about it. I remember as a correspondent there, if I ever went to Ukraine, people would say, oh, ask if we can have Crimea back. And I don't think this was something that is such a huge symbolic value. He knows he'll go down in history, however this turns out, as the Russian leader who got Crimea back for Russia. And Syria too, Russia once again projecting power on the international stage.
And Daniela, it's interesting, this is almost exactly the opposite of when we were discussing elections in the West about how actually foreign policy doesn't really matter unless it's a time of of war, what really matters is the economy. In Russia, it seems like it's the other way around, because the economy is going down the toilet, but foreign policy is impressive for Putin, if you want to put it that way.
Absolutely. I think it is a matter of national pride. And I don't think we can discount the immense effect that control over the media plays. I mean, we can look at Russia Today, for instance, and think it's a little bit gauche and a little bit obvious, but the media landscape in Russia is very, very much slanted in support of Putin on so many different levels. Alternative narratives are not so easy to access, and they're just not popular.
Okay. A team of refugees will compete at this summer's Olympics in Rio, it was announced this week. According to the International Olympic Committee President Thomas Bach, by welcoming the refugee team to the Olympic Games in Rio, the committee wants to send a message of hope to all refugees across the world. A total of 43 refugee athletes have so far been identified for the team of refugee Olympic athletes, which will compete under the Olympic flag. James Rogers, this is rather a nice story.
It's a nice idea, I think. I mean, the age in which we live, and we read constantly about how there are more people on the move as a result of war and other armed conflict than at any time since the Second World War, it is nice to sort of get the occasional good news story. And one would imagine as well, you know, refugees generally have lost everything. If you're a promising athlete, it would be nice at least to be able to go and run your 200 metres or lift your weights or whatever you've trained to do before you had to leave your home. So I think good for the Olympic Committee for organising this.
It's strange. I didn't see it as such a positive story.
Oh, really?
At all. No. I
mean, Why not?
Because it seems a very strange way in which we're viewing refugees as some sort of amorphous entity. You know, refugees are refugees, when actually it's a group of people from incredibly diverse circumstances, countries and experiences. And I think there's this tendency to see refugee as a kind of symbol. I mean, there was recently on this program, we were discussing the idea of some multimillionaire creating an island and creating Refugee Island, and that would be the new nation state of the refugees.
Okay, that strikes me as a terrible idea.
Well, it's a terrible idea, but I think the idea that that refugees can be on Team Refugee, I also think that's a little troubling.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I guess, look, it's not saying that refugees that have actually been given citizenship in another country can't compete for them. In fact, we are going to see a number of athletes who were refugees who are now competing for other teams. But surely this is actually at least recognising, in a way that you don't see in the United Nations or anywhere else, that refugees are being taken seriously.
I'm to be even more cynical, I think it's also just a bit of a PR move from an Olympics which isn't getting very great coverage.
It is, of course, there is a PR element to this, but I think, you know, once again, it's also saying if there are so many million people who have been forced to leave their homes for because of war, at least when the world gets together for the Olympics, they're not entirely forgotten about, even if I would agree it's a fairly symbolic gesture.
A symbolic gesture, but, you know, despite the fact Daniela disagrees with this, I think better than nothing, too. Daniela, obviously, you, as you mentioned, you know, the Olympic movement doesn't have the greatest reputation at the moment. In fact, no international sports body has the greatest reputation at the moment. I challenge you all to come up with an international sports body that
has... Is there an international bowls organisation?
Oh, you don't want to get started on those. All sorts of scandals, I'm told, allegedly. But, Daniela, is it not actually... You know, a good thing in that this is one thing that a sports organisation can do to show that it has changed a little bit, and that it isn't just about the money. It is about, you know, there is this ideal of what the Olympics is supposed to be about. You're shaking your head again.
I'm shaking my head. It's pure PR. It's PR. I mean, we can talk. We were talking about Vladimir Putin and how he's reworked Russia's self-image, and he's used sports as an enormous tool of soft power. And the idea, and not just him appearing topless, wrestling a bear, but also in terms of hosting competitions, in terms of the international presence in the sports field. So no, I'm sorry, we're still very, very far away of play up, play up, play the game.
Fine, but there is still one. I'm going to get you both to agree on this. Kosovo will be appearing at the Olympics for the first time. They'll be flying their flag. And again, James, that at least shows that on the international stage, that would be the most prominence Kosovo's probably had since it claimed its independence.
Yes, it has, which is still not recognised by, you know, a lot of countries, after
indeed.
All, including members of the European Union. So it's there'll be a bit of politics.
And members of the European and members of the United Nations Security Council, Daniela.
Yeah.
I'm rubbing my chin here.
Okay, fair enough. I think it's just sport. You just have a problem with sport. That's all we have time for here on Midori House. My thanks to James Rogers and to Daniela Pellet. The programme was produced by Marcus Hippie. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Marie Justi. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Carlotta Ribello is up next with the Atlantic Shift. Then at 1900, it's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. Do stay tuned for that. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.